Greetings and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Friday, May 5th of the year 2017. It's a new month, and I'm still getting used to writing down May instead of April. I'm failing miserably so far, but the month is only 5 days old, and I still have plenty of time left in the month. So around the 20th, I should get it down pat. I hope I'm not alone. I am Mike the Legend, who hopes he's not alone. Obviously, if you're listening to this, it means I'm not alone because you've joined us to listen to this program. Thank you. I'm going to stop rambling now.
Yes. And
just
practice
my penmanship in writing.
Yes, I am the other voice on this program who is currently not practicing his penmanship or writing. So this week, I'm Dennis the Cross Consumer.
Who are you now?
Yes, by cross, I of course mean a little bit miffed.
P.O.'d.
P.O.'d.
Ticked, yes. Even.
Ticked. Yes.
What has ruffled your feathers?
Well, you know how online storefronts are sort of all the rage these days and sort of threatening to kill a lot of the brick-and-mortar industry?
Indeed.
You know, not only with their prices, but with their, you know, wide selection and, you know, more and more reasonable shipping rates and stuff. And generally fast service, especially when you're talking about some of the bigger sites. Don't want to specifically call out anything. We're not sponsored by anyone or anything, but
you know which ones.
You know which ones we're talking about. Like there's one big one that I'm sure everyone uses. But I tried to actually go to a brick and mortar store today to pick up something.
How quaint.
Yes. I went there because I checked their website. Their website is basically also one of these electronic storefronts.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, instead of purchasing it, it sort of like guides you to a local store. So they have a stock checker, which, you know, in my mind should be up to date, right? Why would they have it if it's not?
That's true. That is a useful piece of information to communicate to the consumers via the website. It's handy.
Yeah. So I looked at the stock on their site. The item I wanted to purchase said it was in stock. And I looked through their site, and it looked like there was a couple of different indicators. There was, like, out of stock, there's low stock, and then there was in stock. To me, in stock sounds like it's not low stock. It sounds like it's, like, ample stock.
Readily available. Like plenty on the shelf.
Yeah, like, if it was low stock, it would have said low stock, because it said low stock elsewhere on their website. So I go down there, nowhere to be seen on the floor. I go and ask someone to look in the back. Without even looking, the person tells me, with confidence, we don't have any of those in. It's like, well, your website says you do, so can you go check in the back? Well, I can check, but I'm pretty sure we don't have it. So he disappears for a couple minutes, comes back. Yeah, we don't have those. Let me just check our computer system. At which point I'm like, why? it's like, oh, yeah, well, our computer system is normally a little bit more up to date than that one. Well, why have it? Why have it at all? Why have it at all? Then, of course, they're like, oh, yeah, this one other store way off, you know, in this other part of the city, they apparently have two in stock, so that's your best bet. You want me to call ahead there and let them know you're on your way so they can put it aside? I'm like, no thanks, bye. Like, you've lost the sale with your stupid system.
Well, you were foiled by technology, weren't you?
Yes.
Frustrated.
Yes. There is a part of me that's actually thinking of actually spending a little bit more and just getting it on said online retailer that I'm not going to mention, but you know what I'm talking about. Which, you know, might not be a terrible idea.
Well, true, you'll, of course, given the price of the item, enjoy free shipping.
Of course I will.
You will have ample clearance over that.
Yes.
But I wonder how much of this occurrence, is you, the consumer, being miffed, and the other part was web developer Dennis, who was miffed.
Well, there's both, because if he's telling me that they have a system that they use that's more up to date than the other system, why aren't the two systems connected vaguely to each other in some sort of way? Like, why doesn't the website actually have up to date stock information? Why?
This is true.
How often does it sync? Why isn't it often enough that, like, when I checked three times over the course of the last 2 days just to make sure that it's in stock, that didn't once say it went down to low stock or out of stock? Is it just a complete farce?
And it's hard to imagine there'd be some sort of quick run where whatever stock they had on the shelves or in the back, what have you, was instantly gone.
No, I don't think this is the type of item that would have done that. I mean, full disclosure, I was looking at a set of, you know, weights, like some adjustable weights kind of thing, whatever, trying to get vaguely in shape. And, you know, I want to have a bunch of adjustable weights without having a whole rack of weights.
Exactly.
Whatever.
I mean, it makes sense from a, you know, space standpoint.
Yeah. So whatever the case, it's like, you know, a plus $300 item. So, you know, you'd figure, like, they should have done anything they could to have, like, kept me in there to get me to buy it, because what's a $300 item? Do you not want me to buy this thing off of you? Because I'm going to go and, like, not come back here now because your system sucks. And also, you're so kind of dismissive about this whole thing. Oh, yeah, well, you know, can't trust the website. It's like, well, I'll trust other websites then. Thanks. Ones that actually work. Idiot.
I have had somewhat of a similar instance with a bit more in-depth site. There's another Canadian retail site that offers actually more information on products on its page, where it'll tell you not only if an item is in stock at one of its retail locations, it will...
But how many are in stock, right?
How many? Which aisle
yes.
in the store it is in? By, you know, you select which location you're going to go to.
I think I know the site you're talking about.
Indeed. And I have been led astray by that more than once by being told where in the store, which aisle to find it in, only to arrive at said location and find out it is not there. And then kind of wander around, lost for a bit, wondering, where the hell is this thing? I was told it's here. I don't understand. And I think I gave up in a huff.
Yeah.
And probably acquired whatever other goods I needed and went about my merry way. But that's another interesting aspect, to provide the actual location in the store, and it's not there. So, what the hell?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's frustrating, and if they're wondering why more and more people are turning to these online locations, hey, this is a valid reason why. Kind of, you know, I was hoping to just kind of not have to deal with waiting for a couple of days for shipping and wondering whether or not it's going to show up or how it's going to be left on my porch or whatever. No. Guess I have to do that now.
True. But hey, free shipping.
It's true. Better be free shipping. $300+ item.
Well, all right. Well, perhaps you can develop a better system.
They can pay me.
They can do that thing. But we'll move on from griping about the retail ails of the world as they affect us, and no doubt some of you out there as well have encountered and experienced these issues yourself. We'll move on and get into some more worthwhile topics to talk about on this program. We'll start with the ludicrous leadoff section of the show, where we have a couple of items we've come across over the past several days that are just a little bit kind of crazy that you should know about. One, it's actually kind of a good positive story. The other one, which we're starting off with, less than a good positive story.
Yes, I think we should actually just start this one off with just playing a clip.
I'm playing a clip? All right, we'll explain it after.
Yes.
Hey, Doc, have you heard about this new technology?
Are you speaking about this new algorithm to copy voices?
Yes, it is developed by a startup called Wirebird.
This is huge. They can make us say anything now, really anything.
The good news is that they will offer the technology to anyone.
This is huge. How does their technology work?
Hey guys, I think that they use deep learning and artificial neural networks.
Hillary is right, and I can tell you that their team is great.
I wish them good luck. I'm sure they will do a good job.
Yes, you heard that right. And also, no, you didn't hear that right.
So let's just kind of unpack what that was. That was a demo MP3 clip that we played for you of a new, program in artificial intelligence, really, that is able to mimic human voices.
Yes, it's a new algorithm that mimics human voices and sort of improves speech synthesis. And, of course, those three voices they were mimicking were Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and, of course, Hillary Clinton.
Indeed. And this is significant, and we're talking about it because, well, computers are now being able to learn how to speak more like humans and sound like humans. So no doubt by this point, we have all seen clips on TV, whatever else, on YouTube of, say, Stephen Hawking communicating as part of a lecture in a TV series or whatnot. And the system he uses to communicate, the voice it uses, is very much a stilted, computery sounding voice.
It's a very archaic system as well. Like, I think it's from the 80s. And, you know, he's been given the opportunity to upgrade it, but he's never wanted to because it works for him, and it's sort of become an iconic voice at this point.
Yes.
When combined with the image of him in the chair, seeing that voice, you're like, that's definitely Stephen Hawking. Fair enough. But he's, you know, also been in that situation for a number of years at this point.
He has.
If someone is coming into a situation like that right now, or they know they're going to be in that situation right now or soon, it makes sense that they would want to maybe do something to maybe have a voice that sounds like themselves.
This is true. And to this point, even, say, some of the more advanced computer voice uses out there in Siri or even Amazon's Alexa, those ultimately still sound very computery and distinctly computery.
Yeah. While at some point someone, there was a real person that was recorded to form the basis of all of the sounds, it's still chopped up in a very stilted way. I mean, the person wasn't recording words. It wasn't sort of, the person didn't actually record phrases or anything, and there's no, they didn't do any sort of flow with the voice. They just sort of recorded a series of something like 2,000 consonants and sounds and clicks and pops and stuff just to get it all stitched together via the software. But this seems like it's going to change that.
It does. And also what it's able to do is, as we said, replicate, mimic a person's voice, a human's speech. And it's able to do this by recording, or what it's been able to do so far is learn and mimic human voices by being fed recordings of a person's speech pattern, as well as the corresponding transcripts of their text, and it's able to analyze the relationships between the sounds and the words, the sounds of the person speaking and the words that are being spoken. And this is all being done using, as Hillary Clinton said in Hillary Clinton's voice, quote-unquote, in that clip said, it's being done using deep learning and neural networks.
Yes, and in case we haven't mentioned it yet, the system that all of these deep learning and neural networks are a part of is a system called Lyrebird, which is a brilliantly named system. Because if you aren't aware, a lyrebird is a type of bird that is known for its mimicry. It's one of the talking birds.
True.
Which is great. It's a great name. Good on Lyrebird for coming up with the name and actually having it be a reasonable name.
And not only that, they are a Canadian startup company based out of Montreal.
Yes. All, of course, makes us brim with a little bit more Canadian pride, of course.
Well, we brim now, but when it helps to bring about the ultimate destruction of humanity, will we be brimming then?
Yes, because there is a bit of a reference we're going to make in a second, which, of course, both of us thought when we were listening to the clip, but
it's an interesting system. It brings about a lot of promise for our interaction with technology and computer devices, to have a more human sounding voice on the other end, but at the same time, perhaps that can allow us as people to relax our guard a bit and maybe a bit too much and feel a bit too comfortable with technology and maybe not regard it as technology as much anymore.
Yeah.
Which then, of course, leads to complacency and then allows a space for robots to overthrow us.
Yes. You know, we maybe go back to this too often whenever we're talking about AI and machine learning and robots and stuff. But Terminator 2, come on. There's a perfect scene in Terminator 2 where this exact type of thing happened. You know, there's that whole phone call that when John Connor makes to his step-parents just to, you know, essentially let him know that he's okay and he hasn't run away. And, you know, here's the dog in the background barking a lot. And then basically the Terminator grabs the phone, mimics John Connor's voice and purposely says the wrong name of the dog. And it's like, what's wrong with Wolfie? And, you know, the foster mother's like, Wolfie's fine. It's just like, your foster parents are dead. Just that on-the-fly speech synthesis.
Mm-hmm. I also was thinking of the end of Terminator 2 as they're having the big climactic fight scene in the steel mill, and they're running through, and the T-1000 is mimicking Sarah Connor's voice to call and draw out John Connor for him to be eliminated, and eliminating the threat. That can happen as well. At least, that's what my mind immediately went to.
Is all the dangerous parts of Terminator 2.
Yes, you know, these things happen. We'll get there one day. I'm sure we will.
Yeah.
And I can't help but wonder, as we get more stories like this of technology improving and computer processing improving and perhaps the speech of a computer improving to sound more human-like, I can't help but wonder, why does Terminator 2 progressively become less of a piece of fiction and more like a prophecy?
I don't know.
Am I wrong in that?
If only it didn't shoot far enough for the date. I mean, we're well past 1997 at this point.
I mean, yeah, but it's not entirely wrong. Ooh, the date might be wrong, but we're catching up with the technology.
It's true. But to be fair, we're also catching up with the technology of other science fiction, other more hopeful science fiction, like Star Trek as well.
True.
So, and, you know, but having said that, though, the Star Trek computer still sounded very computery as well.
A little bit.
I mean, it was Majel Barrett trying to do a computer voice, mind you, but still, one voice throughout all of the different series of Star Trek.
True. So we'll see. And the crazy thing is, as I listened to that initial demo clip with Donald Trump, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton in there, is that actually sounds pretty good for a Donald Trump impression.
Yeah, really. I thought the Obama one sounded pretty good as well. The Clinton one needed a bit of work.
It sounds the most, almost tinny and the most computery to me.
Yeah. And they all have that weird buzz about them. Like it sounded kind of like a buzz just kind of surrounding the voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure with time, that's probably just a resolution thing. It's probably going to get better and better as they perfect their algorithm. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Yes, because this is the start of it. This is Lyrebird's initial thrust of their algorithm and what they can do with it. Others will look at this and try to learn and improve it, and Lyrebird themselves will learn and improve with it.
Yeah, so it's already sort of hard enough these days sometimes to discern real news from fake news from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Does this suddenly become the new unethical tool, kind of like Photoshop was for a while, where people are going to have to become experts in figuring out whether or not a voice was made with Lyrebird or not?
Potentially. Yeah, I think that will eventually happen, and it will be a new way of being able to put words into someone's mouth.
Quite literally.
Quite literally, even if they don't say them. The other, you know, horrible place my brain went to with this, because I was envisioning the dark future it can harbor and bring about, because I was just in that mindset when the news came out about this, is that, you know, I've seen enough movies where military installations have top secret areas that are, say, only accessible with voice commands or pieces of artillery that can only be launched by certain personnel, and in their system they need a voice recognition pattern to get into that area to launch something. Hey, here we are.
Any schlub with a cell phone can now do it as well. Great.
Yep. So, want to get into Area 51? Maybe just record the CO and for a minute and replicate that.
Because that's another thing I don't know if we necessarily mentioned. This is a learning algorithm, so you apparently it's not available to the public yet. I signed up because I'm curious about, you know, more information as it becomes available. But apparently with their system, you just basically get it to analyze any sound clip of anyone. I don't know if there's specific requirements of what the sound clip has to have or how long it has to be.
Or quality.
Or quality or anything like that. But apparently you just give it a sound clip. It'll do some analysis. And then you'll be able to just use the voice.
It's true. According to Alexandre de Brébion, I likely butchered that name and I apologize. I am English.
An anglophone, as it were.
Indeed. He says of Lyrebird, quote, different voices share a lot of information. He's actually, Mr. de Brébion is a co-founder of Lyrebird. He's also a PhD student at the Montreal Institute for Learning Algorithms Laboratory located at the University of Montreal. He goes on to say, quote, after having learned several speakers' voices, learning a whole new speaker's voice is much faster. That's why we don't need so much data to learn a completely new voice. More data will still definitely help, yet 1 minute is enough to capture a lot of the voice, quote, DNA, end quote. So, again, all they've really been using are just 1 minute samples, if not, you know, a bit longer, but really all they need is a minute long sample of someone's voice pattern and voice clip to, get the system and get the algorithm learning what that person sounds like.
Yeah.
Which is concerning. That's
a little bit, yeah.
Because it's going to improve and get faster.
And better and more accurate
mm-hmm.
and sound less stilted and have varied intonation every time. And
now, we link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com. If you're curious, it's well worth taking 5 minutes to check out. They have a host of different demos and voice patterns that the Lyrebird system can produce.
Yes.
And some of them sound very stilted. And there's one specific section of demos that they have using the Donald Trump mimic voice of the system repeating the same words, trying to convey to you, the user, that it is not a robot. It can produce different intonations every time.
Yes, but in doing so, we basically figured out listening, like, I think there's something like 12 or 15 clips, and there's like 3 or 4 different intonations that it kept going back to. So it's like, yeah, it can produce different intonations every time, but there's only a limited number of them that it can produce every time. So, I mean, it's cool, but it's also still definitely a technology in its infancy.
It is. And the other unsettling part of those specific demos where it's trying to convince you of the different intonations it can produce every time is that it literally is repeating the same words. I'm definitely not a robot. I can produce a different intonation every time in every demo clip.
Yeah. So when you hear it in rapid succession 12 to 15 times, it just sounds like a robot's stuck on a loop talking to you like, I am not a robot. I can produce a different intonation every time. I'm not a robot. I can produce a different intonation every time. I am not a robot. I can produce it. It's like, okay, you are a robot and you can sort of produce a different intonation every time. But yeah.
It's a little unsettling. I did make the suggestion to Dennis that he should just record a bunch of those or just have one and loop it and use that as a ringtone.
I think that'd be funny just to have the same one over and over again.
And just freak out people around you anytime your phone goes off or for any reason, any sort of alert notification or whatnot. But you might be thinking out there, you know, letting your brain run with the horrible future I posited of this voice mimicry algorithm being used to perhaps gain access to military installations, launch heavy weaponry, what have you, convince, an individual Air Force base to launch an attack on something, or whatever the case might be. There are other considerations that you will need to think of with this technology now being out there, as Lyrebird acknowledges on their website in an ethics section, because they need an ethics section.
Sure do.
No doubt some of their instructors and lawyers and or lawyer friends or what have you said, it's probably a good thing.
You probably need this here to cover your ass.
Yeah. This is a totally CYA thing to do.
Yes.
They caution the public and anyone who will read it that the software itself could be used to manipulate audio recordings, perhaps, say, used as evidence in court.
So you could definitely ruin someone's life with this software.
Yes. As they say on the website, quote, "We hope that everyone will soon be aware that such technology exists and that copying the voice of someone else is possible," end quote.
Having said that, though, how many people are going to start using this as a defense, even when it's not, when it hasn't been tampered out, like audio?
Mm-hmm. Just to raise reasonable doubt?
Yeah, it's like, well, it's like, well, I don't think I said that. That could be one of those liar bird things.
The computer said it.
Yeah, someone used a computer voice program to manipulate my voice.
Will there need to be some sort of forensics test done on audio recordings now to look for the difference between a human speech pattern and a computer-generated speech pattern? As there can be a, you know, test done on a Photoshop image to determine whether it's actually the image that was taken with, say, a camera, or was it, has it been manipulated to any degree?
Yeah.
Will there need to be something like that with audio recordings now?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think they do have stuff like that in court already. Like, you do obviously have to verify sources of things, like, mm-hmm. Just to make sure that you didn't just get some person who's a really good impersonator to say stuff, too, because that's always sort of been a problem. But, yeah, it's definitely makes it a lot easier to fake things like this now.
So that's a thing in the world. As if you weren't, you know, just kind of down on the world enough and, you know, maybe you're feeling good and that's, that story just kind of brought you down and you can't help but, you know, think of Terminator 2 and the future that it showed that could very well be here. Let's bring you up. Let's try and raise your spirits and bring some faith back into humanity on your part, because it was just this week that a user going by the handle of Chemist49 on Reddit told a story to, well, the Reddit community of what happened to them. And according to Chemist49, they purchased from eBay an auction for just a miscellaneous box of quote-unquote Blizzard stuff. Just random assortment of Blizzard-related items, what have you. And in this box of Blizzard stuff they bought, they came across a gold CDR that read and was labeled, quote, "StarCraft Gold Master Source Code," end quote. And so what this was the actual source code disk, or one of the source code disks, to the first StarCraft game. Which is crazy.
It sure is.
That should never just be in a random box.
Yeah. So he sort of went to Reddit to sort of ask for advice on what people thought he should do. And of course, there was the gamut of, you know, advice given from people saying that, like, well, it seemed like most people erred on the side of, like, I don't even want to know, or I don't even know what you would call it, but it's like most people seem to err on the side of, like, making it publicly available,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason.
Upload it to the internet because they want to see the source code, they want to have access to it, what have you, and this is prime. This will have everything. You don't have to try and go into an existing game and find it. Here you go.
Yeah. And while another bunch of people were, you know, in typical internet fashion, calling him a scumbag or scummy, as I believe was the exact quote that someone used for him holding on to it as he was.
Yes, because scumbag is so long to type out.
Yes. And, you know, him having it for like a day and going on the internet and asking for advice is definitely him squatting on this thing forever, internet. But, yeah, he took a few days and thought about it, and he did say that he did hear from Blizzard directly, and they sort of sounded like they strongly urged him to return it using a legal team and stuff.
As you can understand, they would.
Yeah, and they are a giant corporation, so he decided that it was in his best interest to sort of just return it, mail it back, you know, regardless of if they could have actually done anything to him or not. He still didn't want to take the risk, which is fair.
It's understandable because Blizzard being a big company, they could quite easily unleash a blizzard of balls on the user, Chemist 49.
Oh yeah.
And even if they don't actually have a legal leg to stand on, they will still drag you through the process.
Yeah. So he returned it and, you know, he, for his troubles, Blizzard gave him a copy of Overwatch and a $250 Blizzard store credit, which, you know, he was more than happy with.
Cool. That's not unsubstantial.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely at least probably covered what he paid for this box. Fine. he took to the internet again after being contacted again by Blizzard in a rather unexpected fashion.
Indeed, and what Chemist 49 had to tell the individuals following their story on Reddit was that they were contacted with a phone call by a Blizzard employee, and in Chemist 49's words, quote, he asked me if I have ever heard of BlizzCon. I said, well, yeah, of course, but it's impossible for me to go. I live in the East Coast, and the badges are always sold out before you can refresh the page. He said, well, the reason we are calling you is to invite you to BlizzCon, all expenses paid, and we would love to take you out for drinks. End quote. And on top of that, Blizzard also mailed him out a giant box filled with Overwatch stuff, as well as some Diablo PC peripherals and paraphernalia. I think there were some keyboards and in there and just, you know, knickknacks and tchotchkes related to Overwatch and Diablo.
Yeah.
But a full expenses paid trip to BlizzCon.
Yeah. The person went on to say that, or this contacted Blizzard said that they would love to have him out, and then, you know, they'd love to take him out for drinks and hang out and just for him being such a good sport about this whole source code thing.
Exactly. Even going so far as to tell Kotaku, a Blizzard representative, telling Kotaku, quote, that they wanted to show an appropriate level of appreciation to the player for doing the right thing, not just from Blizzard, but on behalf of the large and active community of players who still enjoy StarCraft today, end quote.
Yeah, because, I mean, on the one hand, while it would have been an interesting dump of, like, programming intelligence and insight into how a popular game like StarCraft was made and like the ins and outs of how you could do certain things, there is also that whole issue of once you have the source code, there are people who will exploit the crap out of it.
Oh, mightily.
And I mean, StarCraft is still pretty heavily played. So I mean, it really wouldn't be that fair. I mean, there's already people that cheat, but you don't want to make it too easy for those people.
True enough. And then there also runs into the issue of the whole intellectual property, trademark issues, and whatever else that, as we mentioned, the Blizzard legal team would throw up and try to raise some hell about, which would be not fun to endure. So the easiest path certainly was to just return the disc to Blizzard. But the whole, you know, not just passes to BlizzCon, but we'll fly you out. You get a free trip out of it, and hey, you get to hang with some people from Blizzard? Amazing. Absolutely amazing. And, I mean, the copy of Overwatch and the store credit would have been enough of a reward. I think any of us out there would have been satisfied with that.
Probably, yeah.
Just for returning a simple disc that part of you has to kind of know you shouldn't have anyway.
Yeah, it's like, this was in a miscellaneous, like, dump that someone put up on eBay. Who knows how they got that stuff?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, it's kind of like, you know, like an estate sale kind of thing, where, like, sometimes, like, if you happen upon, like, oh, this is, like, a master tape for some classic album, I shouldn't have this. I mean, this should be in a museum or something. Like,
Or the lyrics from, someone jotting down the lyrics to a classic song or something.
Yeah, like a Paul McCartney thing or a Jimi Hendrix jotted down thing for Hey Joe or something. Who knows? Every now and then you happen upon these things and, usually when you do the right thing, you just feel better about yourself. And then sometimes when you do the right thing, other people recognize that as well. And I mean, I don't necessarily believe in the cosmic idea of karma, but I do believe in doing the right thing. If you're doing the right thing enough, it'll come around and you will be rewarded at some point because,
generally, so you believe in eventual karma.
Yeah, well, I mean, generally, if you're a good person overall, people will recognize that you're a good person and you reap more rewards for being a good person than being a bad person, typically.
That's certainly true, and I fully endorse that philosophy and idea. And a thought I had when I was reading the story is that I wonder if almost the overkill of the, passes to BlizzCon, the trip out there, and, we'll take you out for drinks and show you a good time, so to speak. I wonder if that added portion of it that they tacked on at the end, wonder if that was to deter and or entice anyone else who may come across source code disks floating out there to return them to BlizzCon, or to the people of Blizzard, excuse me.
Yeah. Maybe.
And serve as an incentive and say, you could release it online, but hey, we did this super awesome stuff for this one guy, so maybe you'll get a super awesome thing out of it.
So here's the other question that's going through my mind now, too. What if they went overkill to try to do this because they're afraid that if someone starts poking through the code, they're going to find things? I don't know what type of things, but what if...
Oh, you certainly will find things in a source code.
But I mean, I wonder if, what kind of things are in there that they don't want to get out?
Things that shouldn't be in there?
Yeah.
Could this potentially open up a can of worms for Blizzard?
I don't know.
Just some theoretical spitballing out there. We don't know for sure. Let us know your thoughts. If you came across a source code disk like this for StarCraft or really any video game, be it a PC, a classic PC one, or a contemporary console game, what would you do with it? Would you return it to the company? Would you find a way of posting it online? Would you put it up for sale? Or just put it under your bed and figure out what to do with it later? Email us info@thearcadeshow.com or send us a message on Twitter @thearcadeshow and on Facebook, facebook.com/thearcadeshow. Now, having said all that, we've spoken for quite a bit, and we barely even touched the meat and potatoes of the show because Nintendo has been quite busy releasing news over the past several days, and one of the big pieces of news items they've dropped was revealing the details of the first piece of downloadable content to come for Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. As many of you know by now, Breath of the Wild is an absolutely enormous game, to the point where a speed run clocked in at 49 hours.
Yeah, a 100% speed run clocked in at 49 hours. So it might be a little bit overwhelming right now to hear that Nintendo has announced some solid details about DLC. And the first DLC is called the Master Trials. And it actually adds more to the story.
It does. It's a very substantive piece of DLC. So what we know is that it's the first of two DLCs that are going to be released for the game.
The first of two DLCs does not have story content.
Not yet.
But they did say that there's going to be a second one coming soon after, which will have story content.
Yes.
But they are both substantial in their own little ways.
Yes. The first one we know about, it will come out sometime during the summer. The story one, the second one, will come out around the holiday time, and you have to buy both for $20. You cannot buy them individually. But we know the first one, which is coming out at some undetermined date in the summer, and it itself comes with quite a few pieces of content for the game, though none story related, providing they will still provide players with quite a bit to do. The first item included and mentioned in the piece of DLC is the Master Trials. not uncommon for a Zelda game to have a trials mode.
Or a dungeon that you have to work your way through that has increasingly difficult levels and enemies that you have to beat.
Exactly.
I mean, there was the Cave of 100 Trials, I believe it was in Wind Waker, and they had something similar in Twilight Princess as well.
They did, and so that's been a staple for the past couple Zelda games. This one, they've said, will be 45 rooms in total, and the great reward at the end of it is that you will see the true power of the Master Sword awakened, and it will always be in that glowing, powered-up state. As I've heard from some people, they're kind of pissed off that the power of the Master Sword can fluctuate, and you have to charge it, and then it discharges, and blah. But this will be the full power of the Master Sword unleashed. Cool. Now,
it also adds another thing for hardcore gamers out there who often like to add challenge when they're playing through the game a second time, which is the aptly titled Hard Mode, which apparently makes enemies rank up. So... So if you think of like, you know, some of the first enemies you'd see in the game as kind of like privates, I guess, they will, become, what would the next thing be? Sergeants?
Sergeants? Generals? Probably sergeants.
Probably sergeants.
Then or from lieutenants.
There, from there, sergeants would become lieutenants. Lieutenants would become generals. Generals would become
admirals.
Admirals. Admirals would become rear admirals.
And then brigadier admirals.
And then where, I don't know where the chain colonel goes, but,
Commandant?
Commandant.
Commander-in-chief?
King? God? Master? Super God? I don't know. But yeah, so...
God plus?
So basically every enemy just becomes harder. It's just basically what we're trying to say.
And the enemies will notice you a bit more easily in the hard mode.
Yeah, so if they would have had a... like, I guess you could call it like an aggro range.
Mm-hmm.
Like where... Like, if you're outside of a specific circle, like, we've all seen that in video games. If you run far enough, an enemy will stop following you because you're out of their follow range or aggro range or whatever you want to call it. The aggro range is apparently significantly increased in hard mode.
Goddamn. But another interesting element and addition that is in the DLC for Breath of the Wild, I think is probably the most useful addition to the game. It's adding something called Hero's Path Mode. And what it is that it's kind of a journal that will document every step a player has taken in the previous 200 hours of playtime. So it will also include a slider to track footsteps on a timeline, showing your literal progress through time of where you have been. Nintendo has also said that this works retroactively, so players that have already put a lot of time into the game will be able to see where they have traveled. And this could also be useful, Nintendo says, in helping to identify locations that players have not yet visited into the world and perhaps help them find shrines that they may have missed otherwise or just, not even come across yet, because without thinking, you may have just one section of the map that you have just kind of missed or just kind of glossed over and your adventures and travels have not taken you there. Which, with a game like Breath of the Wild, I can imagine happening.
Oh, yeah. And there's one other really cool... Well, there's a couple more really cool things, but one that I thought was particularly cool was they're introducing a chest. They're not telling you where in the world it is, but they've put a chest somewhere in the world that includes an item called the Travel Medallion. And the Travel Medallion is a nice throwback to, I'd say, Link to the Past with the Magic Mirror.
Indeed.
Now, the Magic Mirror in Link to the Past operates slightly differently, but this this is sort of like how the Magic Mirror kind of works when you're in a dungeon. So I'll just go ahead and say what this does here, and then you can piece it together why you think I think it's like the Magic Mirror yourself. So apparently, with this Travel Medallion, players can make a temporary travel point on the map, wherever they are standing, just anywhere on the map, and then go about their business, travel wherever they want, and then whenever they want, just, I guess, engage this travel medallion once again and bring them right back to the point where they initially left that initial marker. So it's basically like just an on-the-go waypoint for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you could... if you... want to try your luck at maybe a dungeon that you're maybe not ready to jump into yet, you can put a travel medallion mark outside the dungeon in a safe place where you know there's no enemies around, and or if there are enemies sometimes around that you can beat, fine. Put your mark there, run into the crazy dungeon, see how far you go, and then just before you die, get the hell out of there.
True. Twilight Princess have something similar with the weird shaped chicken thing?
I think it did. It's been a while since I played that game.
I'm having recollections of the weird shaped chicken, and then its offspring is what you could place in your marker in the dungeon.
Yeah, now I remember that.
Yeah, and I'm referring to it as the weird shaped chicken egg.
Because it had a human face.
It had a human face, but it was like some weird chicken body with an egg shaped head.
Yes.
And an elongated neck. Now, it was kind of disturbing.
It was really disturbing. But, there are also new masks, including a Korosk mask, which shakes you when you're, near a Korok seed.
Which is useful because there's 900 of them in the game.
Yeah.
And you kind of need all 900 Korok seeds if you want to do 100% completion.
Yeah.
Even though you literally get a shitty present at the end.
Indeed. There's also, with the Master Trials, there's 8 new pieces of equipment that are apparently inspired by characters of past Zelda games, including, well, I want to say one of my favorite stupid characters, Tingle, the creepy middle-aged man who thinks he's a child.
Yes, who is wearing just a tight green bodysuit, yes. Tries to act like and think he's an elf.
Yes.
Or elf creature. Very disturbing. Not quite as disturbing as the weird chicken creature from Twilight Princess, but disturbing all the same in its own right. No release date yet for that piece of DLC.
We do know it will be in the summer sometime, though, so take that what it's worth.
Yes, and when we do know, we will let you know, but we do know that Mario Kart 8 is the next big game to come out for the Nintendo Switch, and really just add a bit more variety to the offerings of games on the Switch from Nintendo, because to this point it's really been Zelda and then just kind of filler in between.
Yeah, Zelda and third-party re-releases, basically.
Yes, but Mario Kart 8, now out, having just released on April 28th, which is, depending on when you're listening to this, only 7 days ago, but Nintendo has announced that Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, which is the re-release of Mario Kart 8 from the Wii U, and upgraded. It's got all the DLC in there, all the DLC characters, upgraded battle mode, all that stuff. Mario Kart 8 Deluxe for the Switch, in its launch day, became the fastest selling Mario Kart game in the franchise's history, selling better than the previous record holder, Mario Kart Wii, because on the first day, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe sold 459,000 copies.
Yes, now by comparison to the Wii version, that was approximately 20,000 more, where the Wii sold the Wii version of Mario Kart sold 433,900 units back in 2008. Ought 8, as we sometimes like to say.
Indeed, a quaint time back then. So that's actually pretty impressive for the Nintendo Switch, and shows that there's an appetite for content, diversified content on the platform.
I think that's fair to say.
But we'll see how the sales for the Switch version of Mario Kart continue, and no doubt there will be a new Mario Kart game to come out at some point in the future. But as we have maligned in the past couple of weeks, we know there will not be a new version or any new versions of the NES Classic Edition because, well, Nintendo just offhandedly discontinued the device.
Yeah, as we talked about at great length last week, still a little bit sour about that, but, you know, it is what it is. But it was still, I mean, it's still baffling that they did so because it sold so damn well.
To the point we actually have some official numbers. According to Reggie Fils-Aimé, who is the president of Nintendo of America, he was speaking to Matt Peckham of Time.com, and he said that the NES Classic Edition, again, that mini-NES that flew off the shelves on the first day and never came back to shelves, you could never find one again, managed to sell 2.3 million units in from the time it went on sale to, I guess, April, I would say, would be the most recent figures. But 2.3 million units, which is crazy.
Sure is.
And that's a worldwide figure. The last estimate was that the device had sold 1.5 million units, but of course, with numbers like that, you could reasonably assume Nintendo would have just kept it going indefinitely.
Either indefinitely or put some notice out to say, hey, we're going to stop production on this date, but maybe we'll make a website where you can actually order your own copy, secure your own copy up until this date, and then we'll just ship through whatever orders we have.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that have been the smarter thing to do?
You would think, certainly, but according to Reggie Fils-Aimé, they originally planned for it to be just for a product last holiday, and they couldn't and didn't anticipate the response it got, and then once they saw the response, they kept adding shipments to extend the product for as long as they could to meet more and more of the consumer demand. But ultimately what it came down to is they just kind of had to move on, and they didn't have the manufacturing capacity or ability to keep producing NES Classic Editions along with Nintendo Switch units, along with units of their handheld systems as well.
Yeah, exactly.
The 2DS, the 3DS, 3DS XL, and the new versions of those as well. Oh, yeah. Hey, by the way, the reason they don't have as much production capacity and manufacturing ability is because there's a new piece of hardware they're releasing too.
Yes, so it's kind of out of nowhere, but also the writing's been kind of on the wall for a little bit. Nintendo has sort of been silently not supporting 3D anymore. Insofar as, like, you remember when the 3DS came out, there was a lot of fanfare on Nintendo's end about how it was, like, you know, this revolutionary thing, it's gonna change how gaming works.
Glasses-free 3D technology.
Glasses-free 3D technology, and there was almost no buy-in from any game developers, and we ended up not really seeing any games with that technology enabled. So in the last couple of years, we've basically heard nothing about 3DS games.
Well, 3DS games that make use of the 3D slider. Well,
no, that's what I mean. Like, yeah. That's what 3DS games.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's almost, on the one hand, it's not surprising that they've decided to axe the whole 3D part, but it still is a little bit shocking for them to come out and just with a whole new model, especially in the midst of this whole debacle with the NES Classic.
Yeah, well, perhaps, their calculations figure they can make more money by producing this new handheld, which is a new Nintendo 2DS XL. It is another entry into Nintendo's kind of crowded handheld lineup.
I believe that's the understatement of the show.
True. It is set for a release date in North America on July 28th at a price point of $150 US or probably 200 Canadian dollars, depending how the loony does by that point. God help us all.
Yes. Of this whole new system, Fils-Aimé said, and I quote, "This new addition to Nintendo's portable hardware line demonstrates our commitment to the handheld market. New Nintendo 2DS XL sports a beautiful clamshell design and offers a great balance between price and performance," end quote. Which is confusing, because I thought the Switch was also a mobile device.
Well, it is, but this is also mobile.
Why? What the hell is Nintendo doing?
Well, it's another, option for consumers to have in Nintendo's handheld lineup.
Why?
To give players choice.
Why?
Players like choice.
Is that true?
Apparently so. That's why Nintendo has all these offerings.
It's like, they killed something that was successful because they don't want to keep looking in the past, apparently. But I guess they also don't want guaranteed money? Is that what I'm hearing? They don't want guaranteed sales. They want to take a weird gamble on putting a second mobile thing out right to the side of their main console, which already is a mobile thing. What the hell is Nintendo doing?
Well, they seem to think they know what they're doing.
Well, at least one of us has to, I suppose. It's good for them to have confidence in themselves.
It's true. Of this new 2DS XL, you might already have seen the 2DS. It is a handheld device that lacks a hinge. It is just basically a slate with two screens that does not have the 3D slider. This is a more refined version of that. It actually is a clamshell design. And actually, from a design standpoint, looks pretty slick.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's nice and simplistic, and it's has a nice, clean, no-lines, minimalistic design.
Yeah.
Looks very modern and nice.
The top half of the clamshell even looks reminiscent of just a smartphone face.
A three-year-old smartphone case, but still.
Whatever. In North America, will come in a black and turquoise accented color scheme. Japan gets that, as well as orange and white with orange accent color scheme. Still has the same power of the new 3DS. Still has the Amiibo functionality. Still has all the same stuff, just lacking the 3D slider. So I think they're kind of aiming for it to still be for a younger demographic. And also price point is different as well. Whereas the, you know, Switch is like $300.
Yeah.
This is only going to be half that price.
Yeah.
So it's a value play.
It isn't, though. I mean, this certainly cost them money to put into, you know, developing. And it also certainly cost them money to, you know, make it.
Oh, it does.
Like, I don't know why they wouldn't just try to make the Switch cheaper.
That might be just a matter of time. They might not be able to make it cheaper at this point.
What I mean is, why don't they just, instead of probably losing a bunch of money up front on this, lose the money on the Switch instead? Get more units in people's hands. I mean, it's already selling like bananas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if they make it even cheaper and increase their production capacity, there's going to be more Switches out there.
There will be, but that also, I can understand the reasoning of not wanting to lose money on the console.
Yes.
Which they did with the Wii U, and we saw the years of struggle with that.
Yeah, but instead
for other reasons too.
I don't know. I think it's weird at this point now to have to spread your, to spread what developers have to develop for across two systems at this point, when effectively they could both, well, one already can take the place of the other in the mobile gaming thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like as a developer, like, I don't know, like, wouldn't it be a little bit annoying to have to develop something that has to essentially be a mobile game and then have to rejig it for this other device that's also a mobile thing that has two screens now?
Well, that assumes that it's the same game going on both devices. The 3DS seems to have its own, very own, very unique ecosystem.
No, but what I mean is, why are you making developers choose still between which one they want to work for?
That is a good question.
And like, as a developer, I obviously want to make the game, my game, for the system that more people have, but it's kind of hard to tell at this point now which one more people are going to have. I don't know. None of this makes sense to me.
And there may very well be a time in the future when the, you know, 3DS handheld line just kind of gets dissolved.
Yeah.
Once the price point of the Switch can come down further.
Yeah.
And, you know, I understand the idea of still having the 3DS and handheld lines because they're at a cheaper price point, and people who maybe don't want to spend the money on the Switch, the accessories, the games, they get that instead.
Yeah. But also, here's another interesting point. If they essentially killed their production capacity on the NES Classic just so they could produce these,
mm-hmm.
why not keep producing the NES Classic as a surefire way to make money so that they could then pad the price of the Switch lower that way? Wouldn't, like, there's all these different, you know, alternate solutions to keeping more people happy in my head that Nintendo could have done, but
without seeing the numbers of margins and everything in production, it's hard to know. It's hard to say.
It is. I think this is a dumb decision, personally. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, I get it. I understand the need, and I've read some commentary out there where, being that this is the $50 price cut to the 3DS XL without being the direct 3D or like $50 price cut to the 3DS XL. You simply release another model that can do the same thing for $50 cheaper. When perhaps your old one is kind of stagnant, it can kind of be a, burst of new energy to the handheld line with this, slick new looking model of handheld. Cool, I get it. And when compared to the NES Classic Edition, can have a longer sell-through cycle. With the Classic Edition, you're literally only just buying it once. There's no potential for further game sales down the road, digital downloads, anything like that.
Yeah.
So a consumer's paying money to Nintendo once, and after that, they don't have to, whereas with the handhelds, the 2DS XL or new 2DS XL, you're paying the price to get the system, then you're paying for the individual games, then you could pay for digital downloads and potentially amiibos for the functionality too. So there's more opportunities, at least in general.
Yes.
And in theory.
All the exact same opportunities that exist for the Switch.
But at a lower price point.
Yeah.
At this point in time, a lower price point.
Yeah, a lower price point. Yeah.
But the time when the Switch comes down in price, or Nintendo was able to reduce the price on the Switch, or hell, just, because they've sold through so much volume and are producing so many units of the Switch, they'll be able to manufacture it for cheaper and either pass that money along to consumer or just reap crap tons of profit.
Yeah.
Will come sooner because as part of an earnings, report to, investors, Nintendo President Tatsumi Kimishima announced that worldwide sales for the Nintendo Switch totaled 2.74 million units in less than a month as the Switch went on sale on March 3rd. And the time between March 3rd and March 31st, Nintendo sold through almost 2.75 million units. 2.74 million units to be exact. When you break down by region, 1.2 million units were sold in the Americas, 940,000 units were sold, in other regions such as,
Europe, Australia, other, who knows where else that could mean, South America, perhaps.
Yeah, not covered by those two regions, yeah. Antarctica, Africa, and 600,000 units were sold in Japan. So, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the attach rate of people buying Switches and Breath of the Wild is over 100% because
yes.
Breath of the Wild sold more copies than the Switch did.
Breath of the Wild for the Switch sold more copies.
Yes, than I should point out.
Switch. Yeah, because it was released on the Wii U as well. And like, you might be thinking, well, of course it did. There's also the Wii U version, but no, the version for the Switch sold better than the Switch itself.
Yes, it sold 2.76 million units,
which is hilarious. And I don't understand.
People buying multiple copies, just getting the game itself, and then the crazy collector's edition?
I suppose that is a good explanation.
But you're paying 80, 90 bucks for the regular game already. Then the collector's edition with the statue and everything is like $150 to $200.
Yeah, so at that point you spent like $300+ on
two games.
Two copies of the game that you're going to play on one copy.
Yes, and also on a system that costs you $300 to $400.
Yes. Enjoy your $600 Zelda experience.
What's it like to be a baller? Tell me that. But elsewhere, Nintendo reported on the success of their big mobile or big smartphone game, Super Mario Run. And also, according to Tatsumi Kimishima, that so far has
It shot up quite a bit from the number in January. Super Mario Run back in January had 78 million downloads.
Mm-hmm.
And as of the earnings report, they reached almost 150 million downloads for iOS and Android combined.
Yes, in March, I believe, is when the game finally became available for the Android platform.
Yeah, I'm sure the Android release was responsible for a good bump in those numbers.
It certainly You'd imagine it would have to be. And so far, the game is available in 165 countries, which is a damn lot.
So, sure is.
Nintendo is still hoping that the number of the conversion rate for downloaders to paid users will go up. But even still, just getting that initial download is a good first step.
Yes. Just full disclosure, I don't know if Kimishima actually said how many paid downloads they have, but 150 million is an impressive number regardless, free or not. So there is that.
Their apps would kill for those numbers. So bear that in mind. I mean, some apps, of course, will have much better, but for really Nintendo's first serious foray into mobile games, good.
Yeah.
Good first start. But in other Nintendo news, longtime employee and really a man responsible for a lot of pieces of Nintendo history has announced that he's retiring. Genyo Takeda, who has been serving as the technology fellow in the Nintendo Brain Trust for the past couple years, will be retiring effective June 1st from the company. He's been with Nintendo for 5 decades by this point. Apparently joined the company in the early 1970s as the company's, quote, first game designer. And what he did was he created an arcade horse racing game called EVR Race, which came out in 1975. It's been with the company ever since. He worked on things such as, well, Punch-Out, the original arcade version of it, and also played a part in developing the analog stick on the N64 controller, and also developed and the ability for battery backup and saving on cartridges such as Legend of Zelda for the NES.
Yeah, which is a huge, like, I don't think that one accomplishment should be understated even a little bit. That's maybe the most important advance that gaming ever had, not having to enter in stupid passwords. That's awesome, and that really set us down a good path.
Allowing for more in-depth game experiences.
Yeah, or not even more in-depth, just less annoying for the user. I mean, I'm sure there could have been a password entry for Zelda, but it would have been a million characters long, and who would want to enter that every time?
This is true. You'd run out of space in the back pages of the instruction manual pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So he will be replaced as technology fellow by Ko Shiota, who's currently for the company serving as an executive officer and general manager of Nintendo's Platform Technology Development Division. So, as I said, Genyo Takeda has been the technology fellow, serving alongside Shigeru Miyamoto, who's been the creative fellow as part of the advisors and kind of
the fellowship.
Fellowship of Nintendo.
Yes.
To kind of advise and guide the company, with Tatsumi Kimishima being less a creative game guy and more a numbers business guy.
Yes.
So they kind of unwound some of Satoru Iwata's roles and hats he would wear and spread them across 3 people.
Yes. Thus, you know, further proving how important of a person he was to the company.
True.
If anything else, but also acknowledging that they don't want to run another person into the ground, kind of like they did with him.
That's a lot of responsibility.
Yes.
But one last Nintendo-related news item, and it's a rumor that's kind of been around for a while, but Kotaku decided to speak of something that sounds really crazy, and ultimately, time will tell if they're proven right, but we just thought it was kind of, you know, enough crazy to warrant talking about this rumor. But according to some people at Kotaku, they say that they've been sent art assets which confirm the existence of a game that's being developed by Ubisoft that will be a mix between some Ubisoft characters and Nintendo characters, which could set up one of the big releases for the Switch later this fall. They're saying it's going to be something called Mario and Rabbids Kingdom Battle. Apparently it's going to be a cross between the Super Mario universe and the Raving Rabbids universe. You know,
yes,
those crazy off-the-wall rabbids that were introduced in Rayman, Raving Rabbids for the Wii, oh god, 10 years ago by this point.
Yes. So this is apparently going to be a bizarre crossover RPG. Obviously bizarre. But, scheduled apparently to come to Switch sometime late summer, early fall, August or September. Ubisoft is developing this game on the publisher's proprietary Snowdrop engine, according to the assets that Jason Schreier of Kotaku has seen. The game's selling points, he goes on to say, are apparently A, turn-based combat, B, two-player local co-op, and C, a goofy sense of humor. So I'm thinking this is sort of a nice callback to the Mario RPG partnership between Mario or between Nintendo and Squaresoft back in the 90s.
Potentially. We've seen, later Mario RPG games in the form of Paper Mario maintain a strong sense of humor.
Oh, yes, but there still was something about the magic of that first Mario RPG game that was never really quite recreated by Nintendo alone.
That's true, it wasn't, and perhaps Ubisoft is kind of what they need. They need that external company to help get them there. There's something about it. But also, that was the heyday of 16-bit, Square RPGs.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of hard to, compare anything these days with those days of gaming, period.
Almost everything they put out as, at least as an RPG, was a hit.
Yes.
So, but perhaps Ubisoft will be able to bring their own magic to it, and it sounds pretty insane. It sounds more insane when you hear the characters that are going to be in the game. And on the Nintendo side, the four characters that will be contributed to this game will be Mario, Peach, Luigi, and Yoshi. Standard four characters, you'd expect them to be there. Kind of surprising Bowser's not there, but hey, what do I know? And on the Ubisoft Rabbid side of things, who are they contributing?
Well, they're contributing four Rabbids who are dressed up as Mario, Luigi, Peach, and Yoshi. Which is hilarious. Just putting that out there.
I'd imagine they'll all be wearing various hats, perhaps drawn on mustaches.
Perhaps a goofy googly eyes.
Ooh. Well, they already have weird googly eyes as it is.
But maybe additional googly eyes.
Oh, I like it.
I don't know. They said it's going to be silly, and that alone should set up what we can expect right there.
I'm intrigued by this. I want to know more, and this seems like the kind of thing that Nintendo would reveal, say, at E3.
Yeah, or at the very least in one of their weird off-to-the-side videos that they release during the time of E3.
Indeed. What they do in lieu of the big stage presentations now.
Yeah.
But one last item of business to get to, non-Nintendo news item to get to, but we're still going to kind of call back to yesteryear, as you said, as we spoke of the heyday of 16-bit RPGs with Super Mario RPG being one of those titles from the Super Nintendo days, but
it wasn't just RPGs. There were other classic 16-bit genre games.
There were, and that we really don't see too much anymore. And
no.
Arcade sports games being one of those genres that has kind of fallen by the wayside. And
yeah, and they've kind of fallen in favor of more realistic, almost like a manager type perspective of
simulations
of sports instead of like the silly, unrealistic, just gamey kind of sports games, not really trying to necessarily follow all the exact rules to the letter, but also just sort of being more intuitive for gamers who maybe aren't as into the sports, but just like fun games. You know, one of the great examples of this would have been the classic NBA Jam.
Absolutely. One of the great sports games of the 16-bit era.
Yeah.
That unfortunately has, fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, they tried to kind of bring NBA Jam back a bit, but it didn't have the same magic that the original had.
And in fairness, I don't know how it could.
No.
But still those original 16-bit ones for Sega Genesis or Super Nintendo, NBA Jam and NBA Jam Tournament Edition, fantastic, but we really haven't seen the 2-on-2 NBA basketball game released too much anymore, but that's going to change on May 9th. If you're hearing this on or, you know, before or after? Well, NBA Playgrounds is the new two-on-two basketball game in the style of NBA Jam and NBA Jam Tournament Edition that is going to release on May 9th for PlayStation 4, Xbox One, PC, and the Nintendo Switch. Fantastic. Day and Date as its competition for a price point of $20 US. Figure out your local currency. But we're kind of excited by this, and we link to the gameplay trailer on our website, thearcadeshow.com. We encourage you to check it out because it has the feel of old NBA Jam. Doesn't quite have the over-the-top announcer.
No, but that's fine. It doesn't have to be a copy of NBA Jam. It just sort of has to, you know, hit similar type points. Like, it doesn't even have to be the same game. Like, because NBA Jam was just one of many crazy sports games that did exist back then. I mean, think of like Robo Wars.
Oh, yes.
Base Wars.
Base Wars, say. Mutant like League Football.
Mutant League Football, or even like NFL Blitz is another good example.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't try to be Madden. It's just a crazy over-the-top sports game, but super violent and just outrageous.
Sure was. And that was the fun and appeal of it. And this game looks over-the-top and outrageous.
Yeah. The characters, you know, are basically caricatures of NBA players, past and present, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in a two-on-two format, which is, of course, a callback to NBA Jam.
Indeed, and instead of being set inside whatever arena of the home team, which you can never really accurately convey in the camera angle of NBA Jam, the old version or the modern one they came out with a couple years ago, it's set in different venues, and the idea being playgrounds, just different parts of the world.
Yeah.
So there's ones where perhaps you're in New York City or perhaps Las Vegas, a beach somewhere, you know, Paris. You travel the world playing two-on-two basketball on playgrounds in these different locales, which is great. Kind of reminds me of Street Fighter.
Yeah, or even like Cruisin' World.
Yeah, which I like. And caricatures with the exaggerated proportions too, because it looks like already it's got big head mode.
Yeah, but by default, that's just the art style.
Yes, which I love. And another aspect that of this game that I think is worth mentioning is that you can kind of pick and choose your two-on-two team. You are not beholden to simply picking a team and figuring out your combination of the two or three guys you want from that team.
Yeah, you're not kind of stuck going like, yeah, I want Charles Barkley on my team, but I don't want, like, you know, whoever went with Charles Barkley, I don't recall.
Yeah, Kevin Johnson, depends on who he played with, be it, I believe, Houston or Phoenix.
Yeah, but like, whatever that case, like, you know, yeah. Like, oh, I want, you know, Scottie Pippen, but I don't necessarily want
Horace Grant,
like, or like I want Dennis Rodman, but I don't necessarily want Horace Grant, or not to rag on Horace Grant. He was a fine basketball player, but yeah, you could grab, you know, Shaquille O'Neal and then say, no, you know what? I want Shaquille to be on my team with LeBron
and have an absolutely dominating team.
Yes, of course.
It's like, well, we'll just be unstoppable.
Yes.
I've made the Monstars, to make a Space Jam reference.
Pretty much. But you can do that. And not only that, but it does have the silliness intact of NBA Jam. At least they conveyed it a lot better in this trailer for this game than they did in the trailer for the trying to bring back NBA Jam. Because you see, like, the crazy dunks and the outrageous shots from downtown, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And this one, when you do some crazy move, you know, hit a, you know, three-pointer from from half court or something, you are actually rewarded with some sort of power-up item that is, you know, just randomly assigned to you in some sort of, they call it, lottery system. So some sort of added benefit, perhaps it's turbo. That's the other thing, this game doesn't actually have a turbo system.
Yeah.
But whatever. Not every game can have turbo, and I'm sure if they included it, then you're literally making NBA Jam.
Yeah. I'm really hoping that Bill Clinton and Al Gore are going to be hidden characters, because that was hilarious.
Good point. In addition to that, there's going to be additional DLC packs added after the release of the game that will just continuously add more and more available players to the roster of NBA Playgrounds. The neat thing is those roster DLC packs will be free.
Yeah, and they don't have any plans to actually add, you know, packs that you'll have to pay for, which is nice and refreshing.
It is, and so you can constantly have an up-to-date roster, or just maybe get a few extra legends in the game, maybe one day actually get Michael Jordan, if they sign the deal for his licensing rights for a video game.
Yeah, who knows? I'm sure is probably not the cheapest thing in the world.
God, no. God, no. Not by this point. So May 9th is when you'll get or be able to play NBA Playgrounds on, as I said, the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, PC, and the Nintendo Switch. So, I don't know. I just kind of find it interesting to me that Switch, you know, is getting a game like this released day and date with its competition. That is not something I'm used to with, you know, a Nintendo system for the past number of years.
Yeah. Just
kind of a history of, you know, with the Wii or Wii U, it'll come out after. It'll be some kind of weird, altered, or neutered version. But, hey, who knows? Maybe this is a trend of third-party companies recognizing the Switch and wanting to be there from the start. But, you know, we are, as I say, being at the start, we are not at the start of this program, and instead, we're getting towards the tail end of this program.
But we are indeed, and that can only mean one thing.
We must leave you with the Blast from the Past segment, the portion of the show where we take some time to reminisce about things, items from yesteryear, days gone by, days of old, things that you may have entirely forgotten about that could be collecting dust on your shelves, or if you're a younger individual, you may have never heard of or even enjoyed at any point yet. We wish to point these things out to you for historical significance, you know, as being worth your time. And we have technically three items this week, though two are kind of lumped together in a 1A, 1B scenario.
I think we maybe, in this case, we should go in reverse chronological order.
Very well.
So from newest to oldest. So back in the early 2000s, Sam Raimi, who, you know, classic filmmaker at this point, responsible for Evil Dead, Army of Darkness. That alone, in my heart, he's one of my favorites still. But, you know, he was also, you know, it was kind of like a trend in the early 2000s, late 90s, that somehow these B-movie directors that had like ridiculous schlocky B-movie horror movies were somehow given these huge properties somehow in Hollywood and were allowed to make these big budget Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Peter Jackson sort of kicked it off with The Lord of the Rings, proving that like, yeah, these schlocky guys can do this. Just give them a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Raimi was in there too, and he picked up the Spider-Man franchise for three films.
He did, because in the 2000s is when Spider-Man came as, you know, the superhero movie.
Yeah.
As part of the modern renaissance of superhero movies.
Yeah. By the time the third one rolled around, which was his last time he was allowed to direct the film franchise, he wasn't doing so good anymore. The third Spider-Man movie was a bit of a train wreck.
And that's being kind.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being so excited to see the third Spider-Man movie.
And why is that?
Because, well, I mean, the second one was okay, but as a kid of the 90s, you know, I grew up in like the height of, you know, the Maximum Carnage, you know, timeline where, you know, there was Venom. Venom was like, you know, a Shades of Grey kind of character where he started off kind of a bad guy and then kind of turned into a good guy when they kind of realized that the same type of alien symbiote that gave him his powers also found its way into the hands of a crazy person who was Carnage. And, you know, it was like a big Venom and Carnage and the whole Spider-Man, you know, with the alien symbiote thing was a big thing in the 90s in the comic books and then like the television series and all that stuff.
Video game form too.
Video game form as well. So naturally, when I saw this, that this was going to be the movie that had Venom in it, I thought, holy crap, this is going to be amazing. And then when we actually saw the movie, it couldn't have been more disappointing because Sam Raimi is not a kid of the 90s. He's a kid of the 60s. He grew up with the, you know, the, like the Sinister Six and all of, like, you know, those old, like,
kind of hokey villains.
Yeah, kind of hokey villains. And, you know, that's fine if you're making a hokey villain movie, but, you know, there were some extenuating circumstances where apparently he wanted the Sandman to be the main villain in Spider-Man 3. And it probably would have been a lot better and forgivable if he was. If they didn't bring Venom in at all, and they just kept it with, you know, Sandman, it would have been all right. Unfortunately, Sam Raimi bowed to pressure and had a bunch of weird stuff with Venom that didn't really make sense.
No, that kind of surprised people who were familiar with the character of Venom, such as we didn't know that the Venom symbiote, which we had seen in the form of comics and cartoons and whatever, was actually something that you could just take on and off as though it were a piece of clothing.
Yeah, which wasn't communicated clearly to us back in the comic and, you know, television or cartoon days, I should say. That wasn't the case.
No, and nor did we know that if you're not wearing the Venom suit, that it has an effect on you as the user of the Venom suit, even when you're not wearing it, because you look like you should be a member of, what, American High, All-American Rejects, or some sort of emo band, or...
Yeah. You go from being a normal...
My Chemical Romance.
Yeah, you go from being a normal-looking person to, like, a straight-up emo.
Yep. Like, emo hair swoop and everything. Now, you might not be familiar, if you're of a younger age, with emo and what that was. I don't want to say that was a cultural movement. That was kind of more of a fashion movement.
Yeah, it was sort of a fashion movement, and, you know, it was like... Some of the musical elements of the popular band still persist, but really, it's just melodic hardcore is all it is. Mm-hmm. It was just called emo because, you know, some, they called the lyrics were supposed to be emotional, whatever. It was all marketing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Spider-Man 3, Sam Raimi, despite the fact that he had Venom at his disposal, the whole Venom storyline, presumably with Carnage to be as a part of it as well.
At some point in future films.
Yeah. He could have opened the door to, you know, essentially making the Maximum Carnage movie, which would have been amazing. He still made Sandman the big bad guy in the movie for some reason, and essentially made Venom easy to swipe away, which was terrible.
Yeah, that story gets wrapped up way too... I don't want to say quickly, because it kind of persists through a good portion of the movie.
It's done very unsatisfactorily.
Yes. It wraps up way too quickly and looks almost too easy.
Yeah. So when it came out and when I watched it, I couldn't help but think of the Poochie episode of The Simpsons when they just decided they didn't want Poochie around anymore. And they just kind of whoop, moved him out of the scene and just wrote on the screen, Poochie died on the way back to his home planet. That's sort of how they treated Venom in this movie. And it was kind of heartbreaking. I was reading Sam Raimi's reasoning, and I get it, but maybe he wasn't the right director for that movie if they wanted to make that movie.
It's true. He had no familiarity with the character of Venom because Venom came out in the mid to late 80s as a creation of Todd McFarlane in the Spider-Man universe. And also, too, we had always seen Venom portrayed as a much larger, more physically imposing character in the Spider-Man universe. Yet when they cast an actor to play the role of Eddie Brock, who eventually gets the Venom symbiote and becomes Venom before Peter Parker gets it and becomes emo. But
they got Topher Grace.
Topher Grace starred
Eric Foreman from That 70s Show.
Who is not physically imposing.
No.
He's basically the same size as Tobey Maguire. And
maybe a little smaller.
If anything, a little smaller. Yet we were accustomed to seeing him as a much, as I said, larger, almost hulking.
Like, a Vin Diesel-type character would have been appropriate for Venom at that point.
Think, you know, the size of The Rock, but in, like, a Spider-Man suit. That's what we had grown accustomed to seeing portrayed.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, That was Spider-Man 3.
Trainwreck killed the franchise up to that point, and I believe Sony decided to reboot it and then made the Amazing Spider-Man movies, 1 and 2, which then had to be rebooted, and now this summer we get Spider-Man Homecoming with Marvel at the helm of a Spider-Man movie.
Which should be good.
It looks good.
Which is nice for a change rather than Sony having it, but even all before that, we still have to go back because, that Spider-Man 3, I don't actually think
we didn't say the date.
We didn't say the date. So it's celebrating a 10-year anniversary at this point because it was released on May 4th of 2007, I should say.
Yes. Star Wars Day of 2007.
Yeah, Star Wars Day of 2007.
But before that, 5 years prior to that, was the first Spider-Man movie, which made, I think it's safe to say, a shit ton of money.
Yes. And was a good movie.
It actually was a really good movie. It was a good depiction of Peter Parker, Spider-Man.
It was a great origin story. I mean, at this point, though, I mean, I'm a little bit done with origin stories because, especially for iconic characters like Spider-Man or the X-Men or whoever else, we don't really need to keep seeing where they came from over and over again in movies. We get it. But this was kind of like the first one. We didn't really get that yet at this point, so this one gets a pass, and it did a good job.
It did, and remember, back in 2002, superhero movies were still an unproven commodity.
Yeah.
There was some success with Blade, there was some success with the X-Men movie.
Yeah, but in the case of Blade, to be honest, I didn't even realize it was a comic book movie. It was not marketed as a comic book movie. It was just sort of marketed as just, here's like a guy that kills vampires. We're playing on the whole vampire thing that's sort of popular.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, vampire popularity never really went away, but it was kind of popular then before Twilight, but just after Buffy kind of thing. But then X-Men was also sort of like a safer bet for comic books because everyone loves the X-Men comics. And if you really screw this up, it'll be, you know, a sign anyways. So they managed to not screw that up, and that sort of opened the door for Spider-Man a bit. Spider-Man, I think, wasn't necessarily as sure of a thing because I think at that point a lot of people in their minds had the 1960s Spider-Man cartoon in their heads, and they probably would have thought, they make a movie out of this?
True, too, and a good portion of any Spider-Man movie would have to be CG rendered because the movements that Peter Parker is making as he's flying through the city as you know, Spider-Man himself, you can't really recreate as a stunt.
No. And back in 2002, still, that was a little bit of a rocky time for CG. Near the end of, well, really the first wave of, like, overdoing CG.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it manages to not, you know, be too ridiculous.
That's true, it doesn't. And Tobey Maguire, good enough in this movie. I don't know if I ever really liked him as a Peter Parker.
No, I mean, I never really. He just had something weird about his whole emotions. Just him in general, I think, is he's a weird kind of actor that I don't really know how to place and don't really know what I think of.
I don't know if he was necessarily best for this role because he, at least to me, looked a bit too old to be playing high school student.
Yeah, that as well. But nevertheless, it still did the job, and it's still worth watching.
It is. I mean,
the Spider-Man origin story, the origin story is the origin story. It's been around forever, and Sam Raimi, as an old-school fan of Spider-Man, if anything else, is the right person to do this.
It is, and there was great casting in this movie outside of Tobey Maguire. First of all, Willem Dafoe as Norman Osborn / the Green Goblin.
Yeah, it was absolutely perfect.
I mean, someone as sinister and somewhat maniacal, slightly unhinged, Willem Dafoe can do that.
Yeah, that is his wheelhouse. That's the character he's good at playing.
Yes. Now, the costume he wore as Green Goblin, very Power Rangers-esque.
Yeah.
Blocky and could be done better, but whatever.
But again, that's still like Sam Raimi's callback to the 60s and being a fan of like the kind of sillier sides of Spider-Man, because really the Green Goblin back in the 60s did kind of look like that.
True, it did look kind of silly.
Yeah.
But also, too, the probably best part of the Spider-Man first three films with Sam Raimi directing, J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson.
Absolutely. That couldn't have been cast any more perfectly.
And he played him. Note perfect.
Yes, absolutely to the letter. It couldn't have been more J. Jonah Jameson. If they ever try to recast J. Jonah Jameson as anyone else, it's not going to be as good as J.K. Simmons. Just period.
To this point, they have not.
Which is good.
Recast anyone, at least in the film franchise, for the J. Jonah Jameson role. I mean, he literally did look like J. Jonah Jameson from any incarnation you think of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But also very much from like 60s Spider-Man cartoon.
Yeah, which was probably the best part of the cartoon. Just the ridiculous delivery of Paul Kligman back then. But yeah, so unlike Spider-Man 3, which is worth a watch if you've never seen it, just to see how badly you can screw up a Spider-Man movie.
Yes, and see what happens when a director is forced to use a character they don't know how to use.
Yeah, so from there, back to the first one, which actually was good.
It was. It had the elements of a good Spider-Man origin story. And this was a major, major movie. This was back in the day when, major summer blockbusters like this, they'd have, you know, the soundtrack, there'd be the hit single off the soundtrack, there'd be the marketing done with McDonald's or whatever, toys and meals, you'd see the Spider-Man drink cans of Pepsi or Dr. Pepper or whatever. This was huge summer blockbuster, and I think it made almost $1 billion at that time. Almost. Or if not a billion, then really close to it.
Well, it was definitely $821.7 million, according to Wikipedia. So
up there.
That's a hell of a lot of money.
It was. And, oh, also another great part of this movie, I should mention before we forget, the first Spider-Man I'm speaking of, Macho Man Randy Savage as Bonesaw McGraw.
Yes.
He is the wrestler that Peter Parker takes on, you know, after Parker just kind of initially gets his powers, goes and he takes part in some kind of wrestling promotion just for some quick cash, and he has to fight Bonesaw. And for some reason, they put this amateur wrestler of Peter Parker inside a cage with Bonesaw.
And by the way, the announcer of the match was Bruce Campbell.
He was, yes.
Who makes cameos in, I think, every Sam Raimi movie.
In these three, for sure. And actually, I'd read that they were kind of planning to make Bruce Campbell Mysterio in later Spider-Man movies if Sam Raimi kept making them.
If he was allowed to go forward with his vision, that would have actually been good casting.
It would have been, because Bruce Campbell played a different role every time.
Yeah.
So it would have fit as being like, you know, just kind of this underutilized, out-of-work actor who eventually becomes, you know, Mysterio. Oh, and Ted Raimi. Cameo in every movie, too.
Yes. Well, it's his brother.
Well, yes.
And also the car. The old Oldsmobile.
Yes. Yes.
Or Buick. Whatever it is.
I think it's the Buick.
They call it the classic.
Yes.
That yellow car that was in Evil Dead 1, 2, and Army of Darkness.
And also now the Evil Dead TV show.
Yes.
And Lucy Lawless in the first one as well, yes. In a cameo. So literally, Sam Raimi and his friends made a Spider-Man movie.
Yeah. And that's why the first one was great. And maybe why none of the other ones are as good as the first one. Because you can't capture lightning more than once in a bottle.
That's true. Now, that won't stop people from trying.
That's true. Especially when it's a company like Sony at the helm. Whose main MO is to make as much money as possible.
This is true. But let's talk about a blast from the past that is not movie or comic book related at all. In fact, let's talk about something that's a video game that is very much a forebearer, a forefather of a genre we kind of take for granted in our modern gaming landscape. Let's talk about a game that's known as Wolfenstein 3D from the what back then was not called the PC, but instead was the, you know, MS-DOS platform.
Yes, Wolfenstein 3D, which is now celebrating its 25th anniversary, surprisingly.
It's getting up there.
Because we just have to make you feel old at every single corner.
Hey, so, we feel it, so you do too.
Yes. And if you don't, well, that must be nice. But, Yeah, Wolfenstein 3D was really, I think, the first pseudo-modern 3D shooter, first-person shooter I'd ever played. Like, it was, I think, just before Doom.
Yes, it was, I think, by a year or two.
Yeah.
And before Quake.
Way before Quake, and, like, maybe slightly after Commander Keen stuff. Yeah, but, definitely, well, it's a game of its time if you go back and play it, but it's one of those interesting things because, well, I mean, it set up the whole Wolfenstein universe really pretty well.
It did. You're as BJ Blazkowicz, who goes around, basically in a Nazi bunker, escaping in World War II, and you literally are just blasting your way out of there the whole time. Now, the interesting thing is, for a first-person shooter, there's also a maze element to this game as well.
Yes, there is.
Because, goddamn, it is hard to find your way around. A lot of the textures on the walls, because it's an early PC game, are all the same.
Yeah, they're all the same. There's no ceilings. They're all just sort of like, just you see columns and stuff to try to fake out, you know,
height
and where the room would end. And you see like walls sort of end at the same point and stuff. But you know, it was 1992 and it was really experimental stuff. Like no one had really experimented with a 3D engine to this level yet. And it was the brilliance of John Carmack or John Carmack and John Romero for their just outrageous programming work, both of which are actually noted computer scientists who've done like papers and stuff, and their work is, you know, in algorithms and stuff is pretty well regarded.
But back then they were just young guys into computer science working for ID Software.
Yeah, just hacking it away, trying to make a cool new game, which I always imagine what it would have been like back then. Like it was, must have sort of had an element of like Wild West.
I'd imagine so because you don't really have rules or understandings of what you can't do yet.
Yeah. So you end up seeing these crazy experimental, just really like this was an experimental game, like, but the experiment paid off because then you started seeing this become a pattern mm-hmm. and other games started kind of following it. And now I can't imagine a world without first-person shooters now.
Oh, God, no. It is solidified as a genre in the gaming landscape, you know, just as RPGs are, as survival horror is, in large part because of Wolfenstein. And I think there's something about the setting of it, being someone escaping through this, you know, Nazi bunker or through these Nazi bunkers. There's something cathartic about just going through and just shooting Nazi soldiers endlessly, too.
Yeah. And something hilarious about the terrible sound bites that they use when you first, you know, see the first boss and he says, Guten Tag, and it's just, why hello? I don't know.
Yes, the sound, well, there's not really music per se, but the sound effects are hilarious.
There is music.
Oh, there is?
A little bit of music here and there.
Okay.
Done by the illustrious Bobby Prince, who, in video game circles, wasn't really that great. Who just sort of ripped off metal bands of the time and turned like riffs into 12-bar blues versions of the riffs. But, yeah, it's still great to go back and look at some of these classic games. It's really easy to find it online. I think you can even play it in your browser on many sites at this point.
I think so. So there's no excuse to not go in and, you know, hear what it sounds like when you know, shoot the primitive-looking Nazi soldier dead, and the, aye!
Yeah.
He lets out, oh, and also the dogs.
Yeah. The German Shepherd.
Ass.
Pain in the ass German Shepherds.
Damn.
Or as they were called over there, Shepherds.
Well played.
Yes.
But, you know, as you go through, you have to make your way, eventually find your way out, get to the, you know, boss, find the boss behind whatever door. Often some big hulking creature that has way too much weaponry.
Yes.
And you have to also you know, work your way through the maze-like structure of the bunker. You come across treasure randomly for points because there's an arcade element of scoring system to it.
Yeah, well, they didn't really know what they were doing yet. That, might as well throw as many, things at the wall and hope, something sticks, right?
That's true. Well, speaking of walls, actually, there's a big element of hidden doors to this game too.
Yes.
So if you're not pressing the action button on every wall panel you can come across, you're not finding every secret room. You're it's not true. Finding the rooms that have the ammo or health you need for that next section you're about to go into. So a big element of discovery to this as well. So you're probably spending more time just walking around or even backtracking than you are doing shooting.
Yeah.
But again, there was only so much they could fit into the game and to make it all work. But without Wolfenstein 3D, I don't know what our first-person shooter landscape, gaming landscape would look like now.
Yeah, it would be very different, that's for sure.
It would be.
It might not even exist. And can you imagine a world without Call of Duty right now?
No.
That's insane. So really, Wolfenstein 3D deserves a lot of credit. And that's why it's a blast from the past this week.
It does, as of, because it was released on May 5th, 1992, making it 25 years old. And before that, we spoke of the, good Spider-Man movie that came out on May 3rd, 2002. And kicked it off with the not good Spider-Man movie from May 4th of 2007.
Indeed.
There is a good looking Spider-Man movie set for release this summer. Time will tell how it all pans out.
Absolutely.
We hope it's good. We've been burned before.
Yes.
In fact, I even recall discussing Spider-Man 3 on this program many moons ago.
Yes. Perhaps back when it came out.
Yes, we did. And spoiling it.
Because we didn't care. It was like, don't see this movie, it sucks.
We tried to save you your $10. If you saw it anyway, you were a fool.
Yes.
That's on you and your conscience. But, you know, if we properly deterred you back then and you wish to thank us, you can email us, info@thearcadeshow.com, or use the contact us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com. You can also send us a message and follow us on Twitter. We are at The Arcade Show. We always welcome more followers to interact with. Or you can also like our page and reach out to us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. As well, you can subscribe to this podcast and get every episode sent right to you. We are on both iTunes and the Google Play podcast section. So that wraps us up for this week. So until next week, everybody, good night.
Good night.